Welcome to the Anarchist World this week. We're your hosts. I'm Beth, and there's Margaret, and Ruth is here as well.
Hello.
And a very happy International Women's Day. If you're wondering why, you're hearing women's voices on the Anarchist World. Today we've got a fantastic lineup for you. We've got some great music, and we've got some, some chit-chat comments about different women who have been influenced by anarchy over the years. And, yeah, I'll hand you over to Margaret for a moment.
Okay, we're really pleased to have Ruth in the studio, who's from a group called the Wednesday Action Group. And tell us a little about the Wednesday Action Group. And also they're having a housing meeting after this afternoon sometime. So tell us a little bit about the Wednesday Action Group. And when is the meeting in particular?
Well, the meeting is from 12 p.m. to 2 p.m. outside Parliament House. It's the issue is the Defend and Extend public housing rally.
And it's one of, I think it's the third, isn't it, in a set? There's been about two previous meetings.
Yes, and I believe there's been a good turn up. I think I went to the last one and got a bit sunburned. There was an excellent turn up, good speeches.
And it's definitely an issue now, isn't it?
Oh, housing, it certainly is, because there's rumours, or more than rumours, going around that the government wants to give over all the public housing. Sell it off or outsource it or put it into private hands like everything else these days.
Or the deserving charities, maybe.
Yeah, or the undeserving charities.
That's right. It makes it very difficult, doesn't it? Especially when a lot of these charities are religious organisations.
That's right.
For people to access them.
Exactly.
Because they can basically pick and choose who they want to give assistance to and who they don't.
Yeah. Yes, because religious organisations say they can claim exemptions under the Equal Opportunity Law. They can be exempt.
Yes, yes.
Even though they're getting public money.
I love that name, Prosperity Gospel. I mean, it's great, isn't it, Prosperity? Let's go back to the Wednesday Action Group.
How it originated?
Yeah, just give us a little bit of background.
Well, before it became the...
Okay, we'll just go back to that in a moment. So we're going to broadcast.
Evil minds that plot destruction. Sorcerer of death construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds.
Welcome to the Anarchist World this week, broadcast across Australia on the National Community Radio Satellite. Listen to the Anarchist World this week, Australia's sacred cow slaughterhouse. Listen to analysis of local, national, international events. Listen to analysis you'll never hear anywhere else.
Welcome to the Anarchist World this week. It's a bit strange hearing some female voices, but this is because it's International Women's Day today. So all the women have basically taken over the studio from Joe, and there he is, locked outside the door. No, Joe, you can't come in.
Get
Don't bother
here.
Knocking. Bye-bye, Joe. It's Women's Day. So you're here with Beth. And
Margaret.
And Ruth.
And we're all going to be speaking about... Well, all things anarchy. We've got a fantastic lineup for you. We've got lots of music. We're going to be speaking about a couple of famous anarchist women in history.
Sure.
And what else do we have, Margaret?
Well, we were going to talk a little bit about the Wednesday Action Group, but we might do that later on because we've got a few other things. Maybe just to give the formal announcement that we're broadcast nationally on Community Radio Satellite from Community Radio 3CR on the lands of the Kulin First Nations here in Melbourne.
And regular listeners, you would expect to hear our usual presenter, Dr. Joe Toscano, but at this time he's having a break. This week is the 8th of March, International Women's Day, and the station is having 24 hours of women programmers.
And you may like to listen to today's International Working Women's Day's other shows, and you can do that via the www.3cr.org.au/streaming, wherever you are in Australia.
And presenters, Margaret, from the Sewer Show. You're a regular Sewer presenter. And now what the Sewer stands for?
Squatters and Unwedged Workers Airwaves. I'm not, I do the fifth show these days, but there are about four different teams that present the Sewer Show. And Beth, you're presenting the Radical Philosophy Show. When is that on?
That's right. That's every Thursday from 3:30 until 4 o'clock. In the studio also is a 3CR listener, phone-in commentator on Talk Back with Attitude Show, and Wednesday Action Group member for nearly 20 years, Ruth Martin. Let's hear it for Ruth.
Dum-da-dum. Welcome, Ruth.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And the Anarchist World This Week radio show. Oh, I see. I'm reading this out. The theme and the card. We've already done that. We're ahead of ourselves. So now there's some radical dates for the month of March, isn't there, Margaret? First of all, we'll start off with the 3rd of March, 1980, Melbourne. In their first stoppage in 75 years, the majority of shop assistants in the central city go on strike.
Right, and on the 4th of March in 1948 in Sydney, thousands demonstrate for rent control, holding up city traffic for 2 hours.
5th of March 1928, Sydney, the militant women's group holds an Australian first International Women's Day rally. Yay! Sydney did it first.
1928. There you go, Sydney. And on the 12th of March in 1999 in Melbourne, protesters blockaded the construction of McDonald's outlet on a heritage site in Coburg. And I should know that because I was there.
Oh, wow. Yes.
Back then.
And the 18th of March 1986, Canberra, members of the People for Public Housing occupy the yet to be opened new Parliament House. That's fantastic. I didn't know about that.
And on the 23rd of March 1997 in Melbourne, a protest by People for Public Housing prevents an auction of public properties in Richmond.
The dates were provided by various IWW calendars. And the 2016 How to Create Trouble and Influence People diary. I haven't actually got a copy of the diary. I do have a copy of the book. What a fantastic book. If anybody wants to get a hold of it, I'm sure you could go into your local library and ask for it.
That's exactly
right.
How to
Create Trouble and Influence People.
Yes.
I don't know if it's in print, but they are going to be bringing out another copy. The book is very good.
Yes. Public libraries are supposed to be non-partisan, non-political.
That's right. Well, we might stop and have a little song. There's a song called, it's track number 4, and it's called Rebel Girl. And I'll tell you a little bit about the song. It's it's written by Joe Hill back in 1911. The Rebel Girl was written by Joe Hill, who is an IWW songwriter, and it's supposedly about Helen Gurley Flynn, who is an IWW union organiser. And the song's by Hazel Dickens, who's an American blues, she's singing it, by American bluesgrass singer who died in 2011, coincidentally enough. So we'll listen to that, then we'll be back with lots of other news.
Clothes. There's the blue-blooded queen or the princess,
you're back with Beth, Margaret and Ruth on the Anarchist World this week. Now, we've already had a brief history of International Women's Day, so we're going to discuss what International Women's Day means to us. Well, I'll start off. What International Women's Day means to me is it's one day of the year where women can actually express their views and just sort of have a bit more of a voice, I think, in the community than all the other days in the year. And it was actually quite funny because Ruth pointed out I've got my dog here, Coco, in the studio with me, and that she's a female dog. So I think it's just not just for human women, but for all female animals all over the world. What do you think, Margaret?
Yeah, no, I think I was thinking 2017, wow, we're still talking about issues for how long? We always thought, you know, that there would be equal pay. And I was talking to Ruth on the way in about the whole thing of work, you know, like equal pay when she was working and what does it mean to us. And it shouldn't, you know, this whole thing of it shouldn't be happening, but it is. And there should be women's representation all over the place. But a thing I liked, I was thinking about the Wednesday Action Group. There is a lot of women in that group. And I think for a group to be healthy, it has to be ethnically diverse, but it also has to have lots of women in it to make it human, I reckon. That I don't know, I sort of get very disappointed sometimes when I go to a group and it's all guys. I think it's very important that there should be lots of women. And a nice thing about 3CR is there are lots of women here, and there are lots of women who do the techie things. You know, it's one thing to talk or even being in a band, being the singer, but the backup musicians, where are the women, you know? And you'll see all these all-male groups. It's very unhealthy, I think. Anyway, what do you think, Ruth?
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly.
Oh, sorry. I'm a bit of an amateur at this. I agree wholeheartedly with what Margaret just said.
Yeah?
Yes. Shall I continue?
Yes, do continue.
Now, would you like me to talk about the Wednesday Action Group?
Yeah, just give us your...
Prior to it being named, some of us used to meet. It didn't have to be a Wednesday. But the first contact I had with Joe Toscano was outside the old Melbourne jail. And the issue at that time was skulls being on show in the museum there. Female skulls and male skulls of people who'd been put to death, normally by hanging. And Joe, we did have a bit of publicity about it. I was the only one who turned up.
A mass demonstration.
And as well, and a reporter and a journalist from The Age. They wanted to know who I was, and I said, well, I'm just here to support Dr. Toscano. And it was quite a good article the next day in The Age. And I think the journalist probably interviewed the curator at the museum, and she said, oh, well, it's done all over the world. You know, there's religious in churches. They have these, I think they're called reliquies or something like that, where they have the bones or something that belonged to a saint, that sort of thing. And that there were skulls all over on show in Cambodia. But eventually, I think we did have some success, and I think they were withdrawn from show, the skulls at the old Melbourne jail. Now, since, I'm not sure when it became the Wednesday Action Group, we've been involved with all sorts of issues. You name an issue and we've been there, whether it's the what's happening at the ABC.
Now, there was quite a funny little incident about what happened at the ABC, and it came up about what does an anarchist look like? Now,
oh,
would you
that's
like,
right.
to, like to tell us
oh,
about
yes.
that, Ruth?
Oh, yes, I've been, yes, I'm handing out pamphlets outside the ABC, and people are saying, you know, I might say you're an anarchist or you're and they want to know what, you don't look like an anarchist. And I said, well, what does an anarchist look like?
Now, I'll just fill the listeners in because they can't see you there, Ruth, but Ruth is a very distinguished-looking woman.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And she either wears purple, she has either a scarf, a brooch, a purple shirt and a purple cape on. Or she'll always be matching, or she'll wear all black and a hat as well. So there's mainly the blue, green, purple, and black, and you know matching handbag, or you've actually got a little pull along bag today. But to look at Ruth, you'd think, oh, it's a very very distinguished woman there. So I can understand why the security guard got a shock, and he said, are you an anarchist? She said yes, and he said, well, you don't look like an anarchist.
Well, you know, that's, people have this attitude about anarchists. They're either quaint or they're dangerous. They're not quite respectable.
If they look like you or me or our grandmother but or our daughter, it's...
I can assure you we don't have tails.
We don't have tails and we don't all have piercings.
And
either.
We don't walk around with grenades or Molotov cocktails in our bags. I got into trouble once at the... Oh. At Smith Street Station, Southern Cross, in other words, where there's usually several police usually turn up just to check on us. And I made some remark I can't think of your name, Margaret, I'm being nervous, to Margaret's husband, Peter. Now, I wasn't talking to the police, but they overheard me. I said something bad. I might have a Molotov cocktail in my bag. Well, the police and me got very, he was very shocked and angry with me. And he said, look, you're old enough to know better.
Definitely.
you should know better than that. Meaning an elderly white-haired person like me shouldn't
Be
treated, yeah, shouldn't be making jokes about... Molotov cocktails. And I said, well, I wasn't talking to you. I was talking to my colleague here. But that didn't cut any ice.
No, you could have told him he was being ageist.
Well, yes, I could have done that.
Right.
Anyway, I think Ruth puts us to shame, so we're going to up the game. We're all going to dress very well from now on.
Well, look, it's just a thing. I suppose it's part of your personality, the way you dress, and I don't dress to please anyone. I dress to please myself, and I think everyone should.
No, that's right. That's
certainly
right.
To please the men in the community.
No, well, that's right, yeah.
Exactly. It's a bit like there's a thing on the internet which is, what does a feminist look like? And they look like anybody.
Of course they do.
And they're men. You know, they're men. They call themselves feminists. There are women. There are lots of different people, different races. What's a feminist look like? What does an anarchist look like?
Yeah.
What does a human being
look
like? Oh,
well, they try to stereotype people.
I think so. There's the demonisation element too.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
exactly. Okay, well, I will launch a bit into, we were going to talk about various women that have influenced us, and they themselves were influenced by anarchism, and Emma Goldman is someone who definitely comes to mind when you think about her influence on anarchism. So I'll talk a little bit about her. Emma Goldman was born in Lithuania and was a migrant to the US. Emma became educated and organized as a garment worker and came out as an anarchist and feminist public speaker. Emma founded Mother Earth magazine. She did speaking tours on abortion, contraception, futility of voting for politicians, support for the Mexican Revolution. She was arrested, harassed by haters, denounced by politicians, and in the bourgeois media spent time in prison. For her anti-conscription and anti-war activism, Emma was jailed and then deported from the USA in 1917. Emma Goldman went to Russia to support the revolution, critical of the Lenin and Trotsky. She was exiled and moved to France. Emma spoke out against the fascist tyrant Mussolini and the repression of Italian anarchists. Emma visited Spain and supported the Spanish Revolution of 1936 at educational and solidarity events outside Spain, for example, in London. The CNT Anarcho-Syndicalist Union, with 1 million members, occupied workplaces and the land. The workers, without bosses, were running their sites, farms, health, manufacturing, transport themselves. To defend their communities, they established workers' militias and soon had to fight off not just bosses, thugs and the police attacks, but military columns led by General Franco, supported by the Italian and German regimes. The pro-Stalin Communist Party and other politicians tried to destroy the workers' revolution within Spain, Portugal and France, increased policing their borders, and sea blockades by Britain tried to stop ships from supporters supplying the revolutionaries. With the invasion of France by Hitler, Emma Goldman moved to Canada, where she died in 1942. Emma Goldman was buried in Chicago in a cemetery where the Haymarket Martyrs of 1886 struggled for the eight-hour day and was buried after they were executed. Some famous quotes of Emma's, which have gone down in time and used by so many anarchists and other people, are, "If voting could change anything, they'd make it illegal. And if I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution." They're amazing quotes that have, you see time and time again on badges and posters. So we have got a little track. It's track number one that we're going to play, and it's called Emma Goldman. It was written by Helen Hill, who was a food, not bomber, and social activist who unfortunately was murdered in 2007 in the aftermath of the post-Hurricane Katrina violence in New Orleans. This song is sung by Anne Feeney, who's a member of the IWW. So have a listen for Emma Goldman, written by Helen Hill and sung by Anne Feeney.
She told me the state is my enemy. The lady on the left saying property is theft. A year in the slammer couldn't keep her mouth shut. J. Edgar Hoover couldn't move her from my heart. I'm talking Emma, Emma, Emma Goldmine.
And we're over to Margaret.
Okay, I think we're going to talk about a person that's inspired me in particular called Lucy Parsons. And Lucy Parsons was an American labor organizer, radical socialist and anarchist communist. She was born in 1853 and died in 1942. She's remembered as a powerful orator, and she also entered the radical movement following her marriage to newspaper editor Albert Parsons and moved with him from Texas to Chicago, where she contributed to the newspaper he famously edited called The Alarm. Following her husband's 1887 execution in conjunction with the Haymarket affair, Parsons remained a leading American radical activist as a founder of the Industrial Workers of the World in 1905 and member of other political organizations. A famous quote of hers, which is loved by class war in England, says the following: "Let every dirty, lousy tramp arm himself with a revolver or knife on the steps of the palace of the rich and stab or shoot their owners as they come out. Let us kill them without mercy, and let it be a war of extermination and without pity. So, pretty amazing woman, I think. And another woman we can also talk about now is Mother Jones, who was also called Mary Harris Mother Jones, who was born in 1837 and died in November 1930. She was an Irish-born American schoolteacher and dressmaker who became a prominent labour and community organiser. She helped coordinate major strikes and co-founded the Industrial Workers of the World. Jones worked as a teacher and dressmaker, but after her husband and four children all died of yellow fever in 1867 and her dress shop was destroyed in the Great Chicago Fire of 1871, she began working as an organiser for the Knights of Labour and the United Mine Workers Union. From 1897, at about the age of 60, she was known as Mother Jones. In 1902, she was called the most dangerous woman in America for her success in organising mine workers and their families against the mine owners. In 1903, to protest the lax enforcement of the child labour laws in Pennsylvania mines and silk mines, she organised a children's march from Philadelphia to the home of President Theodore Roosevelt in New York. And we've talked a bit about her in some of the sewer show, the wobbly ones we do about Mother Jones. We've dedicated some programming to her in terms of songs because there was an anniversary of her death. So, we might go on to Beth now, who's going to talk a little bit.
Yes, I'm going to play an extract from my program, Radical Philosophy, and it's where I'm doing an interview with Professor Kate Rigby, and she's speaking about quite a famous eco-feminist called Val Plumwood. Philosophy
with discussions on freedom,
happiness,
knowledge,
evil,
and rational argument.
With words from Hawthorne, Tatman,
Jenkins,
Hutchinson,
Piercy Alley,
and Plumwood. Let's get radical about philosophy.
Something has gone unspeakably wrong. We humans have made a terminal mess of this earth. Lise Well, 1991. And I'm speaking to Professor Kate Rigby, FAHA, Chair of Environmental Humanities, School of Languages, Literature, Cultures, Linguistics at Monash University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Beth.
Now, could you give us some background information about Val Plumwood?
Yes, indeed. She didn't actually write very much about her own life, very little in fact. So this is sort of based on conversations with her and people who knew her from a long way back. So she was born in 1939 on the eve of World War II. Into quite a poor family, but well-educated family, and they lived on the sort of urban, rural edges of Sydney, near what's now Ku'ringai Chase National Park. And they had a small land grant, and sort of supplemented her father's rather limited income with a small poultry farm. And Val did some of her schooling via correspondence school, which was great because it allowed her lots of time to explore the local bushland and bond with the family's chooks. I think that was probably quite formative for her. Anyway, she did very well at school. She got a scholarship to Sydney Uni, and she majored in philosophy and graduated in 1965 with first class honours. But in the meantime, she'd actually fallen pregnant to a fellow student, and they married, and they had a son in 1958 while they were still studying, and then a daughter 2 years later in 1960, and they were still trying to continue with their studies. I mean, in those days, it would have been normal probably for Val to have given up her studies, but she was determined to keep going. So they agreed to give their little girl up for adoption. Tragically, she was actually murdered by her adoptive father in her teens, and their son, also he died of a degenerative disease in his 20s. So she lost her two children, and she lost her daughter in a sense, you know, two times over. So quite a bit of tragedy in her personal
past. Oh, that's very sad.
Yeah,
yes.
It's really appalling. But, yeah, she talked about that very, very little. You had to, you know, get to know her quite well before she would talk about that. She actually also married for a second time Richard Routley in 1967, and he was also a philosophy graduate. And they moved to Canberra, and Richard was working with the then very eminent and pioneering environmental ethicist John Passmore at the ANU. And Richard himself became a significant environmental philosopher, and in fact he and Val collaborated in the development of their kind of early, you know, radical eco-philosophical thought.
Now, it was quite interesting, but Val chose her last name, didn't she?
She did indeed, yes, and actually she did so after she and Richard had divorced. So she'd taken on his name. They had, in the meantime, they'd actually got some land, basically a bush block near Braidwood in New South Wales, on the edges of Monga National Park, and the forest is, within this forest block, there's an area of extraordinary kind of primeval rainforest, and it's dominated by this amazing tree, the plumwood tree. And so she took her name from the tree. And by this stage also, she and Richard had become very engaged in sort of anti-logging activism, and they'd also co-authored a book called The Fight for the Forest. So in taking the name of this tree, she was, in a sense, signalling her solidarity with all forests that were at risk, especially from clear felling, as well as kind of declaring her special link to the particular forest where she and Richard had built their home. They actually hand-built this extraordinary low-energy circular home in the midst of this forest. So, and incidentally, Richard at that stage also took a different name. He became known as Richard Sylvan, also a name associated with the woods, with the forest.
Wow, yeah, they certainly did have a connection with nature and the forest.
Yes.
Val was the author of several books.
Yes. So following that co-authored book and also a co-edited book with Richard and a couple of other people, she wrote two major monographs during her lifetime. The first was called Feminism and the Mastery of Nature, which was published in 1993, and it's a really landmark work of feminist eco-philosophy, a really significant book. And she followed that in 2002 with a work that really pulls together all the threads of her thought and kind of updates kind of earlier lines of thinking, and that's called Environmental Culture, The Ecological Crisis of Reason. Now, when she died, she was actually working on two other monographs. One was to be called The Eye of the Crocodile and the other Nature and the Active Voice. I became one of her literary executors together with Freya Matthews and Deborah Bird Rose. We enlisted an editor, Lorraine Shannon, to work on the drafts that she had and to pull together from those drafts and also from other previously published works a book, a posthumous work called Eye of the Crocodile. Listeners can actually download a PDF or ebook version of that for free from the ANU ePress. It's a really... we're very pleased with it.
Oh, that's really good. Yeah.
Yeah. Something we could do for her.
Yeah. With her calling the book The Eye of the Crocodile, Val had a near-death experience. What were the circumstances surrounding this?
Yeah, well, it was sort of, I mean, of course it was sensationalised, but actually it was a really important experience for the development of her thought. It occurred in the mid-80s. She was in Kakadu National Park, and she was canoeing on the Alligator River, and it was raining heavily, and she realised subsequently she probably shouldn't have been out on the water, but she was pulled out of the canoe by a crocodile. Crocodiles kill their prey by drowning them, so they do this thing called the death roll, which is sort of like, you know, being in a washing machine, turned round and round and round in the mouth of this great beast. And she was actually death rolled three times before she actually managed to free herself. She actually poked her fingers in the eye of the crocodile.
Oh.
It released her and she managed to pull herself onto the bank, and she was horribly injured. She had really, really bad injuries. She would have died of blood loss except that she was rescued by a park ranger who found her, and she was taken to hospital. That was quite a drama as well. A long time in rehabilitation and, you know, scarred physically for life, but also kind of profoundly educated by this experience.
Now, I think she stated that she discovered that we're really just part of the food chain, aren't we?
Yeah, that's right. So she wrote a little article on it called Being Prey, which came out in the journal Terra Nova, Ecophilosophy Journal. And she always wanted to write something kind of more extensive about this. And that's what she was working on. And that's, of course, what The Eye of the Crocodile is about. And the it's about perceiving herself for the first time, as you say, as part of the food chain, in the eyes of the crocodile, seeing herself in the crocodile's gaze. And what she realised, what really shocked her, was that after a decade or more of working on, you know, becoming an eco-philosopher and critiquing, you know, kind of dominant ways of thinking about nature, she realised that she herself had this idea that because she was human, somehow she wasn't meat. She couldn't be eaten. And the realisation that had actually put her at risk, that she was being, in a sense, hubristic by being out there on the river, because she had suppressed her vulnerability. She had kind of overlooked her position in the food chain. And it informed her philosophy in many ways, including views about food and also about death. And she was very insistent on not being cremated. She really developed this kind of an eco-philosophy of death, or a philosophy of ecological death, which was about actually, at the end of one's life, willingly giving one's body over to be food for others. And so, and if you cremate someone, you kind of remove the corpse from the food chain. So she was very clear that she wanted to be buried in as shallow a grave as possible. And, there were legalities around that, so it had to be, I think it had to be 6 feet down, something like that. But anyway, but so that the critters in the soil could feast on her, and that this would also contribute to kind of verdant growth above ground, and that would indeed feed other critters like the wombat, who was her familiar, the wild wombat who lived in a burrow near her home and came to visit her of an evening. So, yeah, it was really, really formative experience.
Now, that sounds like a really good idea.
And you're listening to the Anarchist World this week, and that was an extract from my radio program, Radical Philosophy, and it was Professor Kate Rigby speaking about Val Plumwood. Now, you've got a few words about Val Plumwood as well, haven't you, Margaret?
I just thought it was important for people, because I came in late. I didn't really know much about Val Plumwood. Her name was mentioned to me a few times around ecofeminism, and I looked her up and did a bit of research because I was just interested in getting a whole load of influential women in the movement, and especially that she was from Australia, because there's so many people from overseas. So I'll just read a little bit about her. She was born in 1937 and died in 2008. She was an Australian ecofeminist philosopher and activist known for her work on anthropocentrism.
That's easy for you to say.
Yeah, it must have been easy every time she said it. From the 70s, she played a central role in the development of radical ecosophy, that's obviously a word too, along with her second husband, the philosopher Richard Sylvain. Working mostly as an independent scholar, she held posts at the Universities of Australia and the United States, and at the time of her death was an Australian Research Council Fellow at the Australian National University. Looking her up, I was very interested in stuff around her death and her influence on a lot of contemporaries of hers writing about her death, and that interview we heard around how she wanted to be buried is very thought-provoking and very confronting for a lot of people, because it's hard enough to think of death and it's such a taboo subject, but to actually embrace it, write about it, have suggestions and talk about it from an ethical viewpoint is pretty mind-blowing. So, yeah, very interesting. So we might listen to a bit of music now. There was a song that we were going to play called You Don't Speak For Me. It's a bit of a blast from the past. Judy Small sang it. And it was topical back then, and there's always people willing to speak for everybody. That's what they're usually called, politicians, but it could be anybody. He'll get up and speak for other people. But it's a great track considering these days the people who are coming out from under their rocks and purporting to speak for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think of that song? You actually suggested it to me, Ruth.
Yes. Well, when I first heard it, I thought, well, that's exactly how I feel. All these politicians and all the people of repute or disrepute,
okay, so
saying that they speak for everyone.
Exactly. So let's listen. Don't speak. You don't speak for me, Judy Small.
You who scribble on walls with your minuscule mind, you who make midnight calls, you who rattle my blinds, the violence you preach is the core of your creed. Well, you don't speak for me. You call yourselves patriots, swastika style. You feed on the fear of the ignorant child. There's no love of nation, nor people, or land in the hatred behind your smile. You don't speak for me. No, you don't speak for me. I've seen where you come from, I've seen where you lead. It's a poisonous fruit that grows from your seed. You stir up the hatred till something explodes. Well, you don't speak for me. You who slaughter free creatures and then call it sport, you proudly display the corpses you've shot. You talk about freedom and rights and control, but you don't speak for me. You who poison the airwaves with Genghis Khan views, you broadcast your bias and call it the news. You say that you speak for the millions out there and deny that you're lighting a dangerous fuse. Well, you don't speak for me. No, you don't speak for me. You don't speak for me. You don't speak for my friends. We've followed that line, seen where it ends. Intolerance, hatred, division and strife, you don't speak for me. You who march in your hundreds of thousands for peace, you who work for political prisoners' release, you who fight the injustice of women ignored, you speak for me. You who combat apartheid wherever it's seen, you who struggle to keep the forests green, you fight for the rights of all people in chains. You speak for me. Yes, you speak for me. You speak for me.
And you're listening to The Anarchist World This Week, and it's International Women's Day. So you're here with Beth, Margaret and Ruth.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about Voltairine de Cleyre. Voltairine de Cleyre is another anarchist from America. She was a contemporary of Emma Goldman's. So her political perspective, she was an American anarchist known for her prolific writing and opposing the state marriage and the domination of religion over sexuality and women's lives. These latter beliefs have led many to cite her as a major early feminist. She began her activist career in the free thought movement. De Cleyre was initially drawn to individualist anarchism, but evolved through mutualism to an anarchism without adjectives, prioritising a stateless society without the use of force above all else. She was a contemporary of Emma Goldman's, with whom she maintained a relationship of respectful disagreement on many issues. Many of her essays were in the selected works of Voltairine de Cleyre, published posthumously by Mother Earth in 1914. And recently a meeting was held this year at the New International Bookshop that I didn't make it to, but you did, Beth. Do you want to just talk a little bit about that meeting, how you interpreted what was happening and so forth.
Yeah, it was really good to have somebody who's speaking about anarchist women. And it was very, very interesting because it not only just gave us the facts and figures about De Clare, but also sort of posed a few questions that we had to sort of think about and try and sort of work out what would have been the possible scenario. And one was she actually went through with a religious education, but when you sort of at a private school, now when you sort of look back at those days, the state school system was not as it is now, and she may have had to travel quite a considerable distance to attend a school. So her parents weren't religious, but she did attend a religious school. And she actually received quite a high level of education for those days, especially a woman in those days. And even after she'd left school, she always wore her school badge on her shirt. And it wasn't really, I didn't think it was any connection with any religion, because if she was an anarchist, as all anarchists are atheists. But I think it was a sign that she had obtained a higher level of education. And I think that she was very, very proud of that. But you know, I see her not just as a person who was well-educated within our education system, but she was also a free thinker. And I think that anybody who's an anarchist has to really be a free thinker and to think outside the square and to even take on ideas that aren't sort of really supported in society, are they? Would you agree with that statement, Ruth?
I'm sorry.
You dozed off there, did you?
I was reading something about
her. Oh, well, read out what you were reading about her.
No, I better not. Yeah, but no, I would agree with that. No, it was interesting reading about her. Interesting that posing the state marriage and the domination of religion over sexuality in women's lives. That's interesting.
Well, now, when was she born, Margaret?
She was born back in 1866.
Now,
which is
to make a statement like that, you know, being born in 1866 is quite incredible, because there's still a lot of women around now who believe in the institution of marriage, but I'm very opposed to marriage. It's a very oppressive, it's a heterosexual, oppressive institution, and I really can't understand why anybody would want to enter into it.
I think for the white goods, maybe, or for the parents.
Well, that's a point. I did have a partner say to me once that they wouldn't mind getting married because they wanted to get all the gifts, all the wedding gifts.
So greed is as good as anything, isn't it?
Well, we are in a capitalist society.
May I say something?
Sure.
I don't know whether this has anything to do with International Women's Day, but I really hate the idea you invite guests and you give them a list
of presents.
Yes.
So you don't.
There's a name for it.
A register.
Yes.
A register. Marriage.
And that's
register.
Part of the big emporiums these days. They have their. And you can go and. As a guest, you can go and inspect what you can buy.
But I think people talk about a tradition, don't they?
Well, tradition. That tradition wasn't around in my. Certainly in my days, and my mother's days, and grandmother's days, you didn't invite people and give them a list of presents that you might like.
Well, I think it was brought up being on the practical side, because people get half a dozen toasters.
Oh, well, bad luck.
Give them away. Re-gift them
the next wedding you're invited.
Well, it is a bit rude, I think, when you've asked
to go
onto this register. Mm. I mean, you might want to buy them a nice piece of objet art from a independently run art gallery,
yes.
For example. I'm sure they haven't got a register, have they?
Okay. Well, they probably would like to.
Yeah, I'm sure they would like to.
I think one of the interesting things was her movement from individualism Which a lot of there are anarchists that are extremely individualistic, and the individualistic anarchism I see is probably represented more in American sort of anarchism. But I think the way she moved from that to a form of mutualism, which to me is becoming more like a cooperation thing, is very interesting. It says here she differentiated herself also from Emma Goldman, expanding on her support for individualist anarchism. Though Miss Emma Goldman is a communist, I'm an individualist. She wishes to destroy the right of property. I wish to assert it. I make my war on privilege and authority, whereby the right of property, the right turn, is that which is proper to the individual, is annihilated. She believes that cooperation would entirely supplant competition. I hold that competition in one form or another will always exist, and that it's highly desirable it should, which is very, it's really good hearing that argument about individualism versus, and that whole thing on sport too, about cooperative sport and how it's wishy-washy and you need to compete. So it's
I don't know whether schools are the same these days, but in my day, that was something that they preached. I don't think everyone doesn't have that competitive spirit in them. And in a way, I think that's good.
I
won't mention her name, but someone who does work here, I was very impressed once when she was being interviewed, and she said when she was at school, there was some sort of race. I don't know if it was the egg and spoon or the something else. Anyway, she went back. There was someone at the school, I think, with Down syndrome. She went back and held her hand and took her along.
I think that's
I thought that was lovely.
I think compassion and cooperation are
more important.
Exactly. There's a song we have written, we've got ready to play you. It's about Voltairine de Cleyre, and it's a contemporary song. It's called Written in Red, and it's... I'm pretty sure it's, let's see what track number it is, just so we know. It's track number 2, Written in Red, and it's from a poem by Voltairine de Cleyre, and it's sung by Un Woman. So have a listen to that and see what you think. Written in Red.
Blazing youth, arson, and flaring brands.
And you're listening to The Anarchist World this week. And we're almost at the end of the program. How fast an hour goes, doesn't it?
And you know that this was a special broadcast for International Women's Day, so women have taken over the studios of 3CR for 24 hours. Okay, so we've got very little time left, so it's thank you so much, Beth, and thank you so much, Ruth. It's been good fun.
It's been very good fun, and thanks very much, Margaret, for all your informative snippets about Lucy Parsons and Emma Goldman.
Baldwin de Clare, and thank you for Val Plumwood, and thank you, Ruth, for talking a bit about the history of the Wednesday Action Group.
Oh, thank you for inviting me to be a participant in this very important International Day.
And perhaps we'll be back next year. All right.